Hey everyone, and welcome to the Narration by George podcast, the podcast on audiobooks, spiritual ideas, and other items of interest. I'm George Taylor, here with the Sinus Voice, and I'm with you for podcast number 23. Sorry for the groveling and nasal and other sounds, but it's Chattanooga in the summertime, and I'm subject to these sinus conditions, so we're going to continue sailing through our 41 books in 41 days. You'll hear me in better voice later. A brief look at all the audiobooks I've recorded and produced over the last year. And let me start by inviting you to join the Helping Hands Press authors and readers for what we call the Thirsty Thursday Party. It's a live call-in radio show broadcast on Blog Talk Radio, and that's blogtalkradio.com. You'll find a link on my website, narrationbygeorge.com. Click on the podcast link to find links to the broadcast as well as to all the books I mention on this podcast. If you don't want to call in, you can listen, and you can even participate on the Helping Hands Press Facebook site. There are contests, chances to weigh in with your opinion on books, reviews on new releases, and you may hear from an author or two about their own work. Join us for this interesting time. It's 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday night, and this next one is August 6th, I believe. If you can't listen live, then the broadcast is archived for you to listen later. Same link is for the archived cast. So let's continue with our 41 books in 41 days. Our first book is a fun little gem, intended for young and young at heart. Pamela Horner has penned Rats, Pumpkins, and Other Rumors, and tells us the real story behind those fairy tales we've all been told as kids. You think you know all about Cinderella? Well, you don't. Listen to this little sample. An hour or so later, Cinderella stepped out of the carriage and nodded to her men. The driver nodded back and drove off. He really does look like a rat, she thought, briefly following the coach with her eyes, and then she surveyed the scene around her. Carefully picking her way around the north side of the castle, she quickly found a little used side door and slipped in, heading down the hallways toward the music and laughter. Dignitaries and royalties were being announced by the butler as they arrived, and Cinderella could see she had arrived in the nick of time. She spotted a dark-skinned woman dressed in a beautiful cream satin ball gown, trimmed with soft pink pearls, looking around furtively as she stood in the receiving line. Cinderella looked at the corsage strapped to her wrist. Looking as if she were rearranging some petals, she accessed the mini-cam and snapped the woman's picture, sending it to headquarters. 15 seconds later, a text popped up confirming a match. She was indeed the Egyptian spy sent to assassinate the prince. Glancing around, Cinderella thought fast. She saw the woman had stepped up closer to the head of the line, ready to be announced and led to greet the prince. Swift thinking and action was essential. Stepping in line behind the Egyptian spy, Cinderella gave a surreptitious quick tug on the hem of her own gown. Hearing the material rip, she squashed a satisfied grin and instead cried out, "Oh, knights and knaves, whatever shall I do?" The dark-skinned Cleopatra barely glanced back before inching impatiently forward. Cinderella bit her lip in consternation, but then her brow smoothed. She took her evening bag by its pearled straps and swung it forward, landing smack in the middle of the other woman's behind. The Egyptian spy yelped and teetered forward a few steps, knocked momentarily off balance by the forceful swat. "What in the devil are you doing, you buffoon?" she growled at Cinderella, smacking at her evening bag. "Oh, I am so sorry, but my heel caught in my hem, ripping it, and it caused me to lose my balance. My apologies, madam, but could I prevail on your mercy if you could let me borrow a whalebone pin so that I can repair my hem? I would be forever grateful. Please," she added, lowering her eyes to hide her tears, "if I don't get to see the prince tonight, this will be my last chance. You see, I'm dying. Probably by tomorrow." The spy's eyes narrowed in suspicion, so Cinderella coughed weakly behind her fan.
and placed a shaking hand to her forehead. "Oh, for the love of dragons! Be quick!" snapped Cleopatra. "Thank you," beamed Cinderella, and then gave another weak cough. "For good measure. Let's just step around the corner. I can't have anyone see my ankles as you pin up my hem." Muttering something about stupid locals, the disgruntled Cleopatra stalked off ahead of Cinderella. As they turned the corner out of sight, Cinderella hiked up her skirts and caught the surprised woman in the side of her head with a roundhouse kick. Momentarily caught off guard, the Egyptian spy went down on one knee but slid into a side roll and hopped up with a kick of her own. Cinderella, anticipating the move, gave a neat spin and swept her arm under the knee of the woman, flipping her onto the ground and landing flat on her back with a humph. Taking out one of her jeweled hairpins, Cinderella stabbed it into the woman's thigh, depressed it, sending a tranquilizer searing through her veins. The woman's eyes rolled back into her head. She whispered, "Mommy," once, burped loudly, and then passed out. Signaling the coachman to come and pick up the downed assassin, Cinderella began to tidy herself up. She needed to get to the prince and let him know what had happened and prepare him for the possibility of further attacks.
That's Rats, Pumpkins, and Other Rumors by Pamela Horner. It's available from Helping Hands Press. You'll find more info on my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com/books. Scroll about 3/4 of the way down on the page and click on the book icon for more information and even another sample from the book. Roots and Wings at Loonstone Lake by Sue Badeau is a story of Frank and Luann Hubert, who decide to buy and reopen an old, long-closed family campground. This is not only for their family, but to provide help and guidance for kids missing stability in their lives. But the campground holds a mystery. Why was it closed in the first place? Will this keep them from reopening the campground? Take a listen.
"Shh, you hear that?" 12-year-old Luann Thomas stopped dead in her tracks as she waited for her cousin Christopher and her best friend Molly Mears to catch up to her. "Hear what?" Chris called out, breathing giggles, faster breathing, almost panting, and then crying. Molly's eyes widened. "Someone's in there," she said, motioning to the abandoned cabin they had come to explore. "Someone's crying in there." Chris began flicking his flashlight from side to side. Luann grabbed his hand, forcing him to stop. "Cut it out, Chris. We don't want to be seen. I can't imagine who could be in there. I didn't see any other boat when we pulled ashore. Did you?"
"No other boats on this side of the island," Chris said. "Maybe whoever it is swam over."
"That would be a long swim in the dark." "Maybe someone lives here," Molly suggested. "In that old abandoned cabin?" "Huh, I doubt it," Luann replied. "Besides, they'd still have to get on and off the island for food." "Then maybe it's haunted." "Bwa-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha," Chris said, holding his flashlight under his chin and making a menacing face. "We should get out of here," Molly said.
"No way. We came here to check out that old cabin, and that's what I plan to do. This makes it even better."
"Chris, you're being so loud. We're not supposed to be here, remember? I don't know about you, but I don't want to be grounded for the rest of the summer," Luann said, adding, "but I would like to check it out more. Let's go back to the edge of the water and walk around to the other side of the island. You know, the side where the cabin has that broken window? Maybe we'll see something."
The three youngsters scrambled back down to the spot where they tied up their canoe and began creeping silently toward the other side of the island.
"Look there."
This time it was Chris who stopped in his tracks, pointing to a boat moored between two rocks.
"Isn't that Uncle Charlie's boat?"
Coming up alongside her cousin, Luann took a good look at the boat.
"Sure is," she said. "Can't miss that stupid mermaid he painted on the side of it. What the heck is he doing here?"
No sooner were those words out of her mouth than the cabin door opened and Uncle Charlie emerged, taking quick strides toward his boat. Someone else was with him.
"Who is that?"
Shh! I can't tell, but we better hope he doesn't see us. All three flattened themselves against the damp sand, hoping they could become invisible.
Uncle Charlie didn't look their way. He and his mystery partner slipped quietly into his boat and pushed off. Soon the rhythmic sounds of his paddles dipping into the water grew dimmer as the boat smoothly glided towards the Loon's Nest campground.
That's Roots and Wings at Loonstone Lake. It's by Sue Badeau, and it's from Helping Hands Press. More info is on my website at narrationbygeorge.com/books. Scroll about halfway down for the Romance and Life section of this page. Click on the icon for the book to find more information and listen to a different sample. The San Francisco Wedding Planner is a book filled with quirky characters. While having passed through San Francisco only one time in my life, I don't know if these characters represent the city, but they certainly represent the image of that city out here in the rest of the world. Let's see, there's the boss, Heather Donovan, who has no time for herself. Her mother, Gloria, is lovesick, and Heather pulls her back from the brink of good taste more than once. Her assistant, Raul, is constantly preening. Indigo, her photographer, is so much the artist. And Mario, the Italian chef, who must have everything just so, or he loses his temper. Take a listen to this little excerpt.
Heather sat down, preparing for the drama that always comes with Mario. "Heather!" he screamed. "The Marchands are making me absolutely crazy!" His voice resonated through the phone, loud enough to be heard throughout the office. She turned back to the lobby. "Mario," she said calmly, "settle down. Nothing can be that drastic. Is there any way you can call back in an hour? We're running way behind schedule and haven't even had time for lunch." She glanced over at the consultation room where Raul was finishing up, hoping he would include her in his lunch plans with his handsome brother. "Not an option!" Mario screamed, and his Italian accent sounded heavier than usual. "Someone has got to get a control over these people." She took a deep breath and switched the phone to her other ear, getting comfortable for her chef's long tirade. Although extremely talented and experienced, his penchant for overreacting and obsessing often got on her last nerve. "Do you know what these people want, Heather? They want a bacon wrapped everything as appetizers, even those tiny little hot dogs. How crass!" Heather grimaced at the thought as his rant continued. "Who are these people? Do they have a stock in a Farmer John's or Hormel's or something?" Heather tried but could not contain her laughter. "No, my friend, they don't. It's their first daughter getting married, and they have no clue what to do. That's why they hired us. They probably thought it was a good idea, but I'm sure with your unique power of persuasion, you can send them in another direction." About that time, Raul escorted the middle-aged couple out of the consultation room with the invitation order in hand, almost purring. "You two made such a delightful choice. We'll get these to our stationers today, and they will contact you when they're ready." He wagged a finger at them. "Don't forget the stamps for the RSVPs, the one with the little flowers on them. We want to keep your theme." Once the door closed behind them, he turned to Brian. "Ready for lunch, brother?" Brian got up, stretched, and said, "Hey, Raul, why don't we ask Heather to join us?" At that point, Heather turned around, praying her eyes didn't show the hope in them. "Don't think so, Brian. She's always too busy to do anything fun. That poor girl has no life at all." Heather was mortified by that comment, but managed to smile. As the guys walked out the door, Brian glanced back and mouthed, "Hope to see you again." Heather's heart skipped a beat. All she could muster was a wink and a quick nod, angrily thinking, why couldn't Raul keep his big mouth shut for once? Momentarily, she forgot about Mario, who continued his rant. She hadn't heard a word he was saying. "And there's the other problem, Heather. I just don't think the entree is appropriate for a reception either. I'll be the laughing stock of the culinary world."
Hoping he didn't realize she hadn't been listening, Heather said, "Come on, Mario. You've dealt with worse. I know you, and I'm sure you'll be able to pull something magnificent out of that chef's hat that will make everyone happy. You always do." Mario, finally appeased, said he would call if there were any more issues and hung up. Heather knew that would be 5 minutes from now. She got up from the reception desk and put the "Will Be Back" sign on the front door. She walked into her office, opened her bottom desk drawer, and grabbed a granola bar before heading to the break room fridge for a soda. With a resigned sigh, she said to herself, "Oh, well, who needs lunch?" The phone rang again, and she knew she should answer it, but she let it go to voicemail. It was probably Mario. All she wanted to do was sit at her desk, put up her feet for a few minutes, and regroup. She was almost dozing off when Indigo knocked on her door. She waved him in, and he sat down on the overstuffed chair in the corner. "Heather, I don't know where these kids got their ideas from. A high school yearbook?" In a childlike voice, he imitated the young couple he'd just consulted with. "We just want something simple. Two of us sitting with a nice backdrop. Can you believe that? I'm an artist, not a school photographer." Heather smiled in agreement, knowing Indigo, the indigent, cringed at conventional requests. He ranted nonstop for about 3 minutes. Before she had a chance to say anything, he got up and said, "Thanks for the air. Got a handle on it now," and headed back to the consultation room. She chuckled a little, thinking about how running a business required skills in babysitting, counseling, and cheerleading. The lobby doorbell rang. Raoul was back from lunch, and so was Brian. They walked into her office. "Wish you could have been there, girlfriend," Raoul said while nudging Brian in the ribs. "We not only got lunch, but entertainment as well."
If this mixture of characters doesn't create a chaotic situation, well, nothing will. That's The San Francisco Wedding Planner. This book is the cooperative effort of Jen Cudmore, Ruth L. Snyder, Michelle Austin Witte, Isaac and Sarah Martin, Sheila Seiler LeGrand, and Patty J. Smith, and it's available from Helping Hands Press. Go to my website, narrationbygeorge.com/books, scroll about halfway down for the Romance and Life section of the page, click on the book icon for more info. We change gears entirely now, from a current-day setting to a possible future setting. Seasons of Change by Michael Gardner is a dystopian look at a time when the entire U.S. government and the economy have collapsed. People are being forced into labor camps by the mafia and the gangs. Our main character, Michael, just wants to stay low and survive so he can get to safety and his family. But that is not to be.
The confrontation came exactly as Michael had predicted. At 9 o'clock the next morning, the first sentry came running in, and after talking to Arnold, was sent back to his post. Arnold found Michael and reported, "There are half a dozen vehicles coming down Battlefield Parkway. The lead vehicle's a National Guard half-ton with twin machine guns mounted on top." "Do we know if they're headed to the east side or the west side of the camp?" asked Michael, referring to the only entrances he had left open. "The east side, just like you said they would. Where's your dog?" "Everybody gets lucky once in a while." Michael looked around for his dog. "Molly's probably slipped off to Amber's grave again. I had to pick her up there twice since it happened. Okay, get everyone into position." The alarm began to move through the camp. Michael and the men took their positions behind the barricade. The rest of the people began to look for trees to get behind or ditches to lie down in. Michael scanned the camp but didn't see Preacher Wilkins anywhere. He mumbled to himself, "Okay, Amber, keeping your promise is about to begin." The convoy of trucks soon made their way around the top of the hill and through the trees. Michael could see the machine guns tracking them as they came around the bend. Michael stood at the center of the barricade, and as the vehicle came closer, Michael raised his hand in a command to stop. Everyone else pressed closer to the wood of the barricade, hoping it was thick enough to stop a bullet. Amazingly, the vehicles pulled to a stop about 20 feet from the barricade. About 20 armed men, wearing their various shades of green shirts, jumped out of the truck and fanned out on both sides. The man behind the twin machine guns pulled the bolts on both machine guns and waited for the command to fire. The passenger door on the truck opened, and a green-shirt officer got out. He had a large pistol strapped to his hip and walked to the front with his hands on his hips, disdain evident in his face. He definitely was not impressed by the few people crouched behind this flimsy barricade. "Are you in charge here?" the officer asked, while all the time he was studying the camp and her occupants. Michael grinned at that and answered, "It really depends on who you ask, but I guess I'll do. Some of my men were killed up here on the parkway. Do you know anything about that?" "Yes, I do," Michael said, and his grin faded. The officer looked at him, and after silence made it clear Michael was not going to volunteer any further information, he continued as he stared straight at Michael. "Whomever is responsible will pay for that." "Your men shot a little girl." Michael studied the officer's reaction and could only conclude that he really didn't care. "Her grave is under an oak tree down the creek, if you would like to pay your respects," Michael responded. The officer ignored Michael. He scanned the area again, taking counts, and considered how best to attack this motley bunch of rebels. Finally, he turned back to Michael and said, "You have 5 seconds to lower this barricade and get out of my way, smart mouth, or I will cut you to ribbons." Michael took a step forward and leaned against the barricade and said quietly, "I don't think so. I think you and your men are going to lay your weapons on the ground and walk back the way you came, or—" "Or what?" the officer spit out. He seemed mildly amused by Michael's implied threat. Michael put his fingers to his lips and let out an ear-splitting whistle. The woods to the right of the convoy came alive with rustling brush as 100 rifles came into view. The officer looked up the line and then turned back to Michael and said, 5-1, but we can still take you." No sooner had the officer spoken than a rebel yell rose from behind the militiamen. The officer, who had raised his hand to signal the machine gunner to turn the machine guns to the woods, froze when nearly 200 people swarmed over the hill, coming down behind the convoy. Those in front were carrying sections of another barricade and used it to very quickly close off the road. The moment the barricades were set, 100 high-powered hunting rifles came to rest atop the barricade. Members of the camp set themselves up and marked their targets. Michael raised his arm in the get-ready signal and continued where he'd left off. "Or die," he said calmly. "Lay down your guns or die." This book takes a look at the issue of freedom, not only personal freedoms, but religious freedoms. Join Michael as he leads a contingent of followers to freedom. The book is available at audible.com, and if you're not an Audible subscriber, this would be a good way to start that subscription. When you do that, the book is free. Check the info on my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com/books. This book is near the top of the page in the action adventure section. Click on the icon for more info. Silver City is a modern-day telling of a Western tale. Graydon St. Cyr is an ex-U.S. Marshal who is an expert in tracking down the wanted. Now he has to find his ex-partner. The Color of the West and the rugged Canadian Rockies come alive in the pen of Murray Pura. Take a listen to this excerpt.
He slept in a motel in Pincher Creek that night, the Rockies to his back, the foothills and plains in purple summer night sprawling before him. A handsome blonde woman kept staring at him as he ate at a restaurant called The Swiss, but he ignored her. This journey was about Ty Brewer and himself, not a woman in denim and black cowboy boots, and he paid his bill and left, never expecting to see her again. To his surprise, he was only a half hour out of Pincher in the morning when he saw a hitchhiker on the shoulder of the highway, and it was the woman in indigo denim and black boots, and now she had a straw cowboy hat, too. He slowed down as he approached. She smiled. but he knew it was not a trip for riders, and as soon as she saw him change his mind and speed up, she raised a handgun and opened fire, shattering the F-150's windshield and clipping an earlobe with her well-aimed shots. Graydon ducked his head as low as he could and went right at her, hitting the gas as hard as he could, and there was a loud thump as she went flying over the pickup's hood and roof, bounced in and out of the bed, and rolled 100 feet or more along the pavement. The blood streak was wide and thick, and her head as loose as a bag of jelly. There were no other vehicles, and Graydon kept going, wind streaming into the cab from the smashed windshield. He put on his aviator sunglasses to keep his eyes from tearing, and threw his hat on the floor. He pressed his left hand against the gash in his earlobe. There was no point in stopping for repairs. Anyone replacing the windshield would see the bullet holes in the frame and the body-sized dent in the hood. What he did do was pull over just shy of a town called Fort McLeod, clean and bandage the bullet wound on his ear, and picked out the jagged pieces of glass from the windshield frame so that drivers could not tell anything had been broken. His phone went off in his pocket as he leaned over the hood. The ringtone was the sound of a rifle being locked and loaded. "Graydon," he said.
"Have some trouble with your front window?"
It was Ty Brewer. "How did you hack into this number?" demanded Graydon.
"Hey, give me some credit. I was the master blaster when I was with the Marshal Service. I could get into anything, physical or digital."
"So do you have a scope on me?"
"I do, but it's not attached to a rifle."
Graydon looked around him.
"Forget it, St. Cyr. I'm far away. It'll take you an hour's driving east and north to get to where I am."
"If it's not attached to a 300 Win Mag," rumbled Graydon, still craning his neck in all directions, "then why'd you send that girl to wax me?"
"What girl?"
"The blonde hitchhiker who blew out my windshield."
"That's not my style, St. Cyr. You know me better than that. And a sniper shot at a mile isn't my style either. If I'm going to kill you, it's going to be face to face."
"Then who?"
"I know your M.O., just like I know my own date of birth. You want to reverse your usual practice of slinging your fugitives over a saddle and bringing them in stiff. You want to bring me in alive. Now, I personally don't want to be brought in alive, but you have to ask yourself, who else doesn't want me back in the States with breath still in my body?"
Silver City by Murray Pura is available from Helping Hands Press. Check out the action adventure section of my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com/books. You'll find it near the top of the page. You click on the book icon for more info. We'll wrap up today with this unique tale of two angels, sisters who are polar opposites. Kiva and Maeve are training for their wings. They are sent to Earth and meet Martha and Lucille and Martha's grandson, Nick. And the fun begins. Sisters Divided is by Joy Ross Davis. Take a listen to a sample.
The concierge opened the door for them at the Mill House restaurant. As he did, he fixed his eyes on Maeve, and he seemed transfixed for a moment. She brushed past him, waved the hostess away, and sat down, uninvited, at a table already occupied, the table where Lucille and Martha sat, awaiting their food.
"No, we can't sit here," Kiva said. "Forgive us, please, for barging into your space. We'll go to another table, won't we, Maeve?"
Maeve didn't budge. Finally, Martha looked at Kiva and smiled.
"Sit, honey. You're welcome to join us." Then she glared at Maeve, who gave her a fake smile as she put her napkin in her lap.
"You're sure?" Kiva asked. "I don't want to bother you,"
Lucille piped in.
"Sit, dear. We don't mind sharing the table with you."
Just as Kiva pulled out her chair, she heard a familiar voice. "Well, well, look who's come to have lunch," Chef Nick said. "So glad to see you both. What can I cook for you today?" Kiva looked up at him, blushed and smiled. Then she lowered her eyes. Very softly, she said,
"I'll have whatever my friends are having, if that's all right."
Chef Nick addressed Maeve.
"And you?"
"Something hot and spicy," she said.
Lucille glanced at Martha and frowned.
Oh, and if it wouldn't be too much trouble, would you mind if I took a quick tour of the famous kitchen? Have time to give me a brief tour, chef?
Maeve asked as she batted her long eyelashes and smiled. Lucille gasped.
Absolutely not, she said. Customers are never allowed into the kitchen. Isn't that right, Nick? And besides, the committee members are here. It's just unthinkable. This award means so much to him.
Nick seemed hypnotized by Maeve. For a moment, he did nothing but stare at her, a delightful smile on his face. And then he spoke.
Perhaps just this once I could make an exception.
Nicholas, Martha said loudly, what on earth has gotten into you? No one's been allowed in your kitchen. It's your trademark. And the committee members, they have to be attended to. Your food must be better than ever, darling. Today is such an important day. Why, I've never heard of such a thing.
Maeve smiled and rose from her chair, extending her hand to Nick. He took it and held on to it as she came to stand beside him. Kiva covered her face with her hands. Martha reached over and touched her arm.
"It's not your fault, dear," she said. "Don't concern yourself. Nick's a big boy. He can take care of himself and his kitchen."
When Kiva took her hands away from her face, Martha noticed again her thick auburn hair, strands of it in wisps about her face, and her beautiful eyes now rimmed with tears.
"Please, honey, it's nothing to cry about, for goodness sake. Please, dry those tears this minute."
"It's only started," Kiva whispered.
"What did you say, honey?" Lucille said. "Now, now, there's no reason to think anyone will be broken-hearted."
There is no telling what Maeve will be up to next time. Check out Sisters Divided at my website. It's narrationbygeorge.com/books. Click on the icon for more info. That's our time for this week. Join me next week for another romp through our 41 books in 41 days on the Narration by George podcast. Remember, you can like my Facebook page. It's Narration by George. And follow the info on these books as well as new releases to come. You'll find me on Twitter as well. I'm at Narration by Geo, and you'll find me on Pinterest as Narration by George. Join me next week when the Narration by George podcast will again be new on Wednesday. See you then. God bless.